Every single day I feel it.
Artlist IO.
Every single day I feel the pressure. Double up the weight, let's make it extra. Working so my mother get arrested. Yeah. Working like I never knew I'm best. Yeah. Every single day I feel the pressure.
Diamonds hey, welcome back to the What Are You Made Of show here. And that was
music licensing reimagined.
It's a Monday here. I know you may not be listening on a Monday. However, it's Monday here. And, you know, Monday's my favorite day of the week. It gets me back in the swing of things. You know, I'm always in the swing thing. Actually, even on the weekends, it's just that the people that I want to serve a lot of times take the weekends off. And that's just the way people are. So it's kind of holds me back a little bit. That's the one thing that can stop me is if other people aren't on, they're off. And so Mondays are my favorite day of the week to get back. Everybody's back and ready to roll. And I think if you start making Monday your favorite day of the week, it could change your life. So anyway, thanks for being here. Appreciate the support, the listenership. If you're watching, thank you. However you're consuming this content. I got another great guest for you today on the What Are You Made Of show. It's Chris Howes in the building. He's a captain with the Niagara Falls Fire Department. He's overcome decades of drug and alcohol abuse and addiction. Now clean and sober, 13 years. Muay Thai and boxing became a big part of his life and recovery. And today he gives back to his community with his treatment center, tattoo shop, podcast, and as a loving father and husband to his son and wife. His show is called the Authentic Adversity Podcast. Go check it out. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Look, I can't wait to hear your story. I can relate to some of the bio I read already. Yeah. And we talked a little bit in the green room prior to the show of, you know, some of the things that gave you some background on me and all that. And I just want to, before we get started, and I ask you this famous question back here.
Yeah.
The website that people can go to check out the recovery is lakesiderecovery.ca. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Lakesiderecovery.ca. Go check it out. Where else can people find you? I like to do this a lot of times. I'm starting to do this in the beginning of the show.
Yeah, no problem. If you want to find my personal page on Instagram, it's _Chris_How_. The podcast is at Authentic Adversity. And if you want to check out the Instagram for the recovery center, it's at Lakeside_Recovery.
All right, guys, go check that out. Chris, let's kick this thing off the right way with the question. What are you made of?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I love that question. So the things that I would say I'm made of are resiliency, strength, hope, and community.
Yeah. Did you think of that a long time, like coming on the show? You knew I was going to ask you that, or did that just come off the top of your head right now?
I thought about it. You know, I thought about it this morning a little bit while I was at the gym, and you know, I was listening to one of your episodes, and I was like, how would I answer that? I hadn't really thought about it, and those are the words that just came to me. So, and those are the real important words for me, for my life that make me who I am today. And also for a lot of the people that I work with, those are the words that I like to instill in them. And, along with those words come, principles as well. And that's just a way to live, right?
Yeah. 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 I love it, man. I love it. All right. Well, let's get into your story. First of all, you know, obviously recovery is a big part of your story. And now, you know, it's a big part of your mission. Mm-hmm. Where did it all start for you? I mean, you know, everybody's got a story. I got mine. Everybody's got a story. What got you into partying and an addiction and all that? Where did it all start?
Yeah, for me, it was early childhood. I mean, I was told as a young child, there was a lot of physical abuse, a lot of mental and emotional abuse in my household. But I was told, and you know, in the 80s, right? Like, make it look good for everyone else. Don't talk about what happens behind closed doors. So I was, from a really young age, taught that I can't share my feelings. And, you know, I was an anxious child. I was, you know, nervous around a lot of people. I had, you know, a lot of stuff going on emotionally that I felt I couldn't let out. I couldn't talk to anybody about. It was that typical, you know, you're a boy, be a boy, like, don't talk about your feelings. And that would, you know, later on in life turn into, you know, you're a man, be a man, and these sort of things. When I was 7 years old, I had an experience with, sexual abuse. I was sexually abused by a female caregiver of mine. And honestly, that's when I think my childhood stopped. And from that point on, and again, she told me, you know, this is our little secret. You can't tell anybody. So this sort of like mantra of like, or this idea that like, you can't share your feelings. You have to hold everything inside, and this is a secret. Everything that's going on inside of you is a secret. You can't share it with the world. It ate me up inside, even at a young age like that. I didn't know what had gone on. I knew that it was wrong, but you know, at 7 years old, you don't really know what that stuff is all about. So I was constantly seeking an escape for my current reality. And so originally it was, I found music, you know, I found punk rock and hardcore. And that to me, like that, the punk rock anthems and the hardcore lyrics, like they were screaming what I was feeling inside that I just couldn't get out myself. Right. And the people that I was hanging around, you know, I was hanging around with a lot of punks and skinheads, and it was violent. It was exciting. It was, you know, a lot of older kids than me. And, you know, I felt like this is where I get to just be me. I get to, you know, I could escape in the music and the chaos of it all. It matched my insides. But that wasn't good enough for me, you know. And at, you know, 12, 13 years old, when I had my first real drink of alcohol, it changed my life. Like with that first sip of alcohol, all my fears, my anxieties, my doubts about myself, my, you know, the secrets that I was holding, all that stuff was washed away with my first sip of alcohol. And, that first time I drank, I got blackout drunk. You know, and I have never known how to drink differently since then. So I got blackout drunk. I didn't know what happened that night. I just knew that I could finally feel like I could be myself. And when I woke up that next morning, I had a community around me. I had people around me that were laughing, that were joking, they were telling me I was funny and come to the next party. And you know, I had attention from females that I wasn't getting before that. So I associated, you know, all this community and attention with alcohol. And, you know, the people I was hanging out with were a couple years older than me. So I was able to access that stuff a lot easier. And, you know, drugs very quickly came into the picture, and I was the type of guy, and I am this type of guy, right? I will ingest anything you put in front of me if you tell me it's going to make me feel better. And that's just the way I lived my life. So, you know, by the time I was 17 years old, I had become like an IV user. What once brought me community, friendship, a sense of belonging, and really that escape that I was desperately seeking, started to push people away. You know, it was like, I used to be the guy when I showed up at the party, it was like, yeah, he's here. It was a big deal, you know, like I felt it was a big deal at least. And then I stopped being invited to all those parties. And when I did show up, it was like, oh fuck, he's here. You know what I mean? So, you know, I tried a couple different things. I tried to escape geographically, and I tried to do the kind of quote unquote geographical cure. And I moved out to New Zealand, of all places. And I thought, hey, if I'm going to outrun my problem, I'm going to go to the other side of the planet. And I could, you know, I don't have to be Chris the alcoholic, Chris the drug addict, Chris the criminal. I could just be Chris. I can reinvent myself.
Where did you start? Did you start in Niagara?
Started in Niagara, yeah.
Okay. Because I know that's where you are now, right? But like, I didn't know if you started there.
Yeah. I've moved all over the place, but I grew up in Niagara, and so 17 years old, I went out to New Zealand, dropped out of school for, you know, a semester, and I thought I was going to reinvent myself. I was going to clean up. I was going to meet new people, have new experiences, and you know, like the saying goes, you know, you try to outrun your problem, but you bring yourself with you, right? You bring all your problems with you, and I wasn't seeking actual recovery at that time. You know, I was just trying to outrun it, and you just can't. And so I got out there, and I met people that were just like me, and even worse, and you know, found new drugs to try, new ways to make money. It was almost like a little educational trip for a drug addict and a criminal. My trip didn't last too long. I wasn't welcome there much longer. So I came home and I finished high school, and I tried to do this a few times. You know, I moved down to the Caribbean, I moved all over the States, and always the same result. You know, it was always chaos everywhere I went. I was, you know, it was chaos, self-loathing, you know, hatred and violence. It was always just the same narrative in a different place. And, you know, that was really frustrating for me because I knew, you know, I knew I was a drug addict. I knew I was an alcoholic and I couldn't stop on my own, but I didn't know the solution. I was just, you know, I was trying everything I could, but not really looking at, you know, the problem, which was internal.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Look, yeah. I can relate to a lot of this. Mm-hmm. Fighting. I was the first to hit someone if I thought they needed it. Like,
yeah.
I thought I was the judge, executioner, jury, all that jazz.
Right.
You know, and I was always trying to become, I think, the same like thing when like alcohol, weed, cocaine, like ecstasy, all these different drugs that are out there, right? Like that, yeah. you're trying to like figure out how to become what you want to become, mm-hmm. and use that to, and sometimes at first, this is why it's so dangerous. At first, it makes you feel like Superman.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And or Hugh Hefner or whatever person you want to think that you want to be. Right.
Yeah.
And that's what grabs you. And then before you know it, like you don't even realize this is happening, but before you know it, things start to get dark. Like you yeah. said, like when you go to the party and people are like, oh, he's here. Like that is a situation that puts you in a worse situation than when you had all the problems. So
that's right.
A lot of self-hate came into what you're doing, and that hate starts to reflect upon other people, right? So
100%.
Can you talk about that? Like that, the hate that you had inside, which you didn't realize probably I don't think we do. We realize that we hate ourselves. We start hating out and projecting on other people. Mm-hmm. And then how you overcame that part.
Yeah, for sure. It took a very, very long time to overcome, but, I was jealous of other people. I was envious. I couldn't figure out why, life would seem to work out for everyone else. Why, you know, I would blame my circumstances. I would blame other people. I would blame my surroundings. You know, I wouldn't be like this if this thing didn't happen to me. If, you know, when I was, my mom ended up getting thrown in jail when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. I leaned in on that a lot as like the reason why I am the way I am today. And, you know, I was making excuses, right? And I had no idea, just like you said, Mike, like I didn't know that I hated myself. I just put all my self-hatred out to people, places, and things. And so whatever it was, whatever I was feeling about myself, I projected it onto other people. Unfortunately, most of the time it was the people that were closest to me that were affected by this, you know. And you know, you'd lash out on somebody in a blackout or not. Sometimes just, you know, just because you had nowhere else to put your pain. And for me, and that really, like I talked about that narrative early in my life of like not being able to share what I'm feeling, I couldn't say to somebody, hey, like, you know, I really hate the way my life is going. I'm not proud of who I am today. It was like, how can I put you down to make me feel better? So backwards, right? And the solution to it was very simple. I had to get honest with myself. I had to get real with myself, and I had to be humbled in a way enough to say, you know, I have a problem. I need help. And this is all my fault. And, you know, for me, when I was 22 years old, I was working in a factory, and I was in the throes, like heavy throes of my addiction. And, you know, there was an old guy, a big, big biker looking dude, tattoos up and down his arms, like big beard. He'd always stare at me every morning, And I couldn't figure out, like, what did I do to this guy? Did I piss him off? You know, am I about to catch an ass kicking or what? And he came up to me one day and he said, you know, kid, I've been watching you. And, you know, if you ever get sick and tired of being sick and tired, you can give me a call. And I had no clue what that meant. And he gave me a piece of paper with his name and his number on it. And, you know, I put it in my wallet and I didn't think much of it. But 3 months later, I found myself kind of desperate at a bar, drinking, running up a bar tab that I couldn't pay. Drug dealers weren't answering my phone calls. Like, that's how bad it was getting, you know. And I had no friends. I had nobody around me. I was just desperate. I couldn't pay for my bar tab. And as I was looking through my wallet for maybe a credit card I'd stolen or something like that to pay for this tab, his number popped up. And I went to a payphone and I called him. And I said, listen, his name was Terry. And I said, Terry, you said you could help me if I get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I think I'm pretty much there. And he said, stay where you are. I'm coming down to meet you. He came down to the bar, paid my bar tab, brought me across the street to the coffee shop, got me a sandwich and a coffee, and he told me his story, and he had been sober for 18 years at that time. At that time, I had no idea, no clue that anybody could live a happy life in recovery. I thought that the rest of the world lived the way I did. They were just lying about it. You know, I'd watch the people go to work on a 9-to-5 job and think, no, they're not sober. They're not like they're driving to a dealer. They're driving to the bar. They're not going to work. You know, I was so blind to what life could be because I was so stuck in what life was for me and what I had created. So he brought me to my first meeting, and you know, at 22 years old, I was by far the youngest guy in the room. I went into that meeting and I compared myself to everybody. I didn't try to relate to anybody, which is what I needed to do to find any kind of peace in that space. I said, no, these people aren't like me. I'm not that bad yet. You know, this stuff hasn't happened to me. I'm, you know, yeah, I got a problem, but it's not that bad. And, you know, that sent me into a 10-year stretch of jumping into the rooms of recovery and out. And I would go into the rooms of recovery for whatever reason. You know, a girlfriend was pissed off at me, so I'd say, nah, you know, I'm going to make it look good. Just, I'd go into the meeting and say, don't worry, I'm getting sober. I'm doing something about my problem. Or I'd get caught, got trouble with the law. I'm going to meetings. Everything's going to be fine. In that meantime, I had gotten a job with the fire department. You know, I sobered up long enough to be able to be hired, first of all. And so that was a manipulation of its own. But, you know, one of the first things I heard from a senior firefighter when I went to my first day at work was that, you know, he came up to us and said, if I can give you guys one piece of advice to carry through the rest of your career, it's to not show your weakness around here, because we prey on our weak. You're paid well to see the things that you see, you know. And again, this man up, suck it up, walk it off, or drink about it. And so that's what we did, right? Like, again, I'm being told I can't share about my feelings. So, you know, getting into a job like that when you're a drunk, a drug addict, a criminal, and you have like no idea who you are or who you want to be, it was a scary place to live for me. So, you know, I would go about my career. The first 8 years was spent in active addiction. And I saw a lot of things that I wasn't equipped to see, you know. And I'll say this. I don't think anybody, there's no amount of training that can equip any human being to see some of the things that we have to see. We think we can handle it. We say we can handle it. But internally, we are broken. Anybody who does emergency service work or military, anything like that, frontline work, this is just the reality. Like, it breaks us. And and instead of talking about it, this is what we do. We go to the bar and we drink about it.
Yeah.
And that's the acceptable.
Suppress.
Yeah. And that's the acceptable culture, you know, in those types of careers. So you know, as much as I thought that that job was going to make me give me some respect and give me some, you know, people are going to look at me and say, oh, he's actually made something of his life. I felt very trapped in it. You know, and I'll bring you to the kind of the last days of my drinking and using. As I said, I had been jumping in and out of the rooms of recovery from age 22 to 32. And I had 3 suicide attempts in that time. And this is just to say how desperate, lonely, and full of hate for myself I was, that I felt I had no other way out but to try to commit suicide. I woke up one day, in fact, it was January 2nd, 2011. And I had the plan, like, I just can't live like this anymore. Like, my life is, I had no idea how I let my life get to that point. And, I thought that I gotta go. I can't stay on this earth. I gotta take myself out. And I sat and I wrote down possible ways that I could commit suicide that day. And in that moment, and I don't know, some people will call it like a spiritual experience or whatever. I don't know what to call it, but I was hit with a wave of emotions. And all those times that I compared myself to the people in the rooms, the people in recovery, all the all the things that I said, no, that doesn't happen. That hasn't happened to me yet. You know, I still have a job. I still have a relationship. I still have this. But all those things, and, you know, those things were starting to happen to me. I was starting to lose a lot of things. I was starting to get in trouble with, you know, with the cops and that sort of thing. But all those things hit me at one point, and it just made sense to me. I thought, I'm exactly like everyone in that room. I need what they have. And I didn't know what that was, but I just dropped the pen. I crumpled up the piece of paper. I lit it on fire. And I looked up the first meeting that I could find. And I went there, and it was the same room I had gone into for 10 years. And people would see me in and out, in and out, in and out, you know, relapse after relapse. And I walked in, and it just felt different. You know, I was waving that flag, that white flag of surrender. Do you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I went in with a different set of eyes, a different set of ears, a different heart, you know, and I just said, you know, the first person that shook my hand, I didn't let go of the hand, and I just bawled my eyes out, and I cried in front of another man, which I hadn't done in my entire life up to that, but my entire adult life up until that point. And it was like the floodgates just opened, and I started telling them everything.
And weight comes, you can actually feel lighter.
It like, is unreal.
Right?
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It was like I was carrying around a backpack and two suitcases full of boulders. And every time I shared something new, one of those boulders was offloaded, you know? And just like you said, you just feel like it's so therapeutic that you do feel like you're lighter. And these kind people in the room, you know, they let me just talk about myself for an hour, and, you know, and they were so supportive, and they were so kind, and they didn't want anything from me but to see me do well. So I walked out of that meeting that day with, you know, probably about 20 phone numbers from people that I could call if I needed, you know, I needed support, I needed a friend, I needed help. I asked somebody to be my sponsor. I made that group my home group. And if from that point on, if I wasn't at work in the gym, or with my sponsor, I was like in a meeting, at a retreat, at a day treatment program, at, you know, something. There was, I in that moment of surrender and that release of like, I need to just let everything from my past out. It was this like awakening of the soul almost. And for me, yeah. it brought up so much, and it gave me space and allowed me to discover who I was, who I wanted to be, and who I was the whole time. But, you know,
layers, man. Like that, by the way, this is the heaviness. There's mm-hmm. a real thing here, bro. Like, energy is real, right? And when you condense energy, it becomes more dense. Becomes more dense. Well, when we're doing the things that we were doing, or you're holding things in, or all these ridges actually build up around you, they're very heavy, and you become actually more dense. That's why they say, like, when you're feeling good and you're like, you're carefree and all that, you're lighter. You feel like you're on cloud nine. Cloud nine's lighter. You're walking on cloud nine. You're walking on air. It's real. That's energy and frequency. And so that's what happens. Like, this is all natural.
It is. And it's amazing. And it's something that you could explain to me, you know, until you're blue in the face, and I wouldn't get it until I allowed myself to experience it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's an experiential thing. It's not something that you can learn. Yeah.
Well, the other thing is, like, you know, you could have killed yourself with drugs nowadays, like fentanyl's like in everything now. And it's like, you know, we're losing people. Like, I lost my uncle recently, my grandmother, and then there's kids around the state. I could just like falling like flies with this stuff, man. So luckily you were able to get recovered and now can help other people, which is powerful, man, because there's nobody that can help people better than people that have been there before.
100%. And that's it. That's why one of my what I was made of is community. Because community helped me. I couldn't have got out of that hole that I had dug myself alone. Community lifted me out of that hole. Community is what drove me to improve my life, to go after the next best thing for me, and also take everyone with me. So in giving back, so I once I got my life on track, what really solidified my recovery and my life is to start giving back to others and helping others through the things that I had gone through that seemed insurmountable at one time. You know, it seemed impossible recovery at one point for me. So as you said, like somebody who has experience, lived experience is the best teacher. I don't care what course you take, what, you know, books you've read, you can do all of it. But until you've lived it, I think you're not fully qualified to talk about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other thing, like, okay, so recovery, when you're working in with recovery and with addicts and all that, they don't trust themselves. So it's very difficult to even trust them. You can, like, so in my experience, I don't work with addicts, but, you know, I've had some people that have been employees that I found out, you know, that could see it and they're drinking and drugs or whatever. How do you help somebody with recovery when you can't trust them?
Well, the same, you help somebody, or I help somebody the same way if I can't trust them as if I can trust them, because in the end, it's helping me. So if I help somebody and I can't trust them and they relapse or they go back out, I haven't lost that time that I've put into helping that person. And that's fed me. That's where I filled up. You know what I mean? I filled up through taking somebody through that stage of early recovery and you know, all those remember whens for me and the drawing on experience and you know, speaking about how I was able to and how other people taught me how to sort of jump the hurdles of early recovery. So whether or not you can trust them, I mean, it doesn't change things for me. You know, if somebody relapses, I feel awful, and I hope is that they come back, that they make it back, and they don't, you know, something awful doesn't happen to them. But I still had a wonderful experience with them in trying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got it. That makes sense. So let me cover a couple things as we're short on time here. I can talk all day about this stuff, but like the sexual abuse part, right? Like a lot of times when people go through that, they become not the victim, but then the perpetrator, so to speak, or the offender, right? And I have a friend, Paul Hutchinson, who was executive producer for The Sound of Freedom and, you know, working on a lot of the things overseas with the trafficking and all this. And one of the things Paul said is they couldn't keep up with all the kids and rescuing the kids that just kept coming, but they could. He's switching his focus now to helping people that have had problems in the past, so the demand isn't there. And so, like, how did you focus on fixing or help, not fixing, I don't want to say fix, but like helping yourself in that part? Because, you know, when you're a kid, it gives you a warped sense of what sex is all about, which romance is all about, love is all about, and all that. Like, how have you confronted that?
Yeah. And well, I can definitely speak to that. It did give me a warped sense of what, you know, sex and love was all about. I wasn't capable, I don't think, of love. And I thought sex was was supposed to be, I don't want to say a violent thing, but like it was supposed to be a very, animalistic type thing with no emotion. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Because that's what was shown to me at an early age, and I didn't know any better. The healing for that has come through, I will say this, meeting my wife, who is a very patient, amazing, wonderful woman who has experiences of her own to draw on, and she's also in recovery. She showed me, she's really helped show me what real love is about, what real intimacy is about. And the other thing is, I started to see a therapist, and I do it's called IFS work. It's internal family systems work. So in that work, you go back to those the young child, so the child in you, and you support and heal that child from the position of who you are today. So I can go back as me today, healing and support that 7-year-old that didn't have the support, that didn't know where to go. And you know, that to me, that's been a life changer. That IFS work has been fantastic. But again, something that I think it's really important to talk about is that, like, as a man, I was very reluctant to share about this stuff. I was very, you know, even in recovery, like, I was talking about everything else in my life. I didn't talk about that incident of sexual abuse until I was probably about 8 years sober. And then I was finally able to let that kind of unlock that last door. And it was a game changer for me because, I was very full of fear, fear of judgment, fear of, being viewed as weak, fear that, you know, I there was something wrong with me. But, in admitting the, and being truthful about what happened came a wonderful opportunity for healing.
Yeah, and you're stepping up as a leader for those that still don't have the courage yet to share,
yes,
for their own healing.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, sometimes, like, this isn't on that specific topic, but like, there's sometimes where I just don't feel like being on social media. Mm-hmm. I'm an influencer on social media. I've done it, but sometimes I'm just like, I'm tired of talking to people if they don't want to listen. I'm tired of preaching this and that, and
yes,
tired of being authentic and vulnerable and this and that. But then I thought to myself one day, it's like, this is an obligation.
Yeah.
I have the courage to do it. If I don't feel like it, I got to do it anyway, because it's going to encourage someone else to do the same thing. And not everybody's built like me.
Yeah.
And since I have this gift, I have an obligation to use the gift I've been given. So that's the same thing with that. And so look, as we wind down, and again, I could talk to you for hours, Chris, but I keep this show around 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Podcasting. What is podcasting? Having your own show and then going on other shows. What has it done for you, your business, your brand? Like, what have you noticed the difference in your life from it?
Honestly, it's connection. It's connection with others that have walked a very similar path as myself, and also connection with people that are doing something completely different that I'm interested in. You know, it's allowed me, I mean, the fact that we're able to connect in different countries virtually, you know, I'm interviewing people that I've been connected with on social media in Australia, the UK, you know, through the States, Mexico, everywhere. And, you know, we can't sit down face to face a lot of times to talk. So it's given me that opportunity to capture that, to first of all, make that relationship a little more real, and to capture it and share it with the world. I mean, everybody has such amazing stories to tell. And, you know, I've met some of the most fantastic people I've ever met in my life through recovery and through podcasting. It's just opened the door, and I'm sure you would feel the same. It's opened the door to conversations that I would never in my wildest dreams imagine that I would be having with people, and relationships that have lasted, which is really, you know, same with me, like with social media and all that stuff. Like, I get burnt out, but when you're able to do these things, it's like, man, this is what it's about. This makes it worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, dude, I want to thank you. And I appreciate you and the courage it takes to go out and share your story, to impact lives. I mean, here's the thing. So when I wake up in the morning, I'm obsessed with helping people. I realize that everybody's unstoppable to live in the life of their dreams.
Yeah.
If they realize it. And so my job is to expose that, and I can't do it all myself. You're on a mission that aligns with my mission. So I want to encourage you. I want to thank you. I'll be praying for you, man, and wishing you all the best. And if there's anything you ever need, dude, you know, we're friends now. So you just reach out.
Absolutely.
I'm one of the best people to have in your corner, I can tell you that.
That's amazing, so, Mike. Really appreciate you giving having this platform for people like, you know, to share and be vulnerable and honest and authentic. And it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. And I know for sure we'll stay connected, and I can imagine that we'll have many more conversations.
Absolutely, brother. Well, hang tight while I wrap this up. Thanks for being here. Guys, thank you for all watching or listening to this show, however you're consuming this content. I really appreciate the support. Can't do my mission without you. And I want to continue to encourage you to keep showing up. Bring some other people here to listen to the show. You know, look, I'm going to continue to bring in great guests and showing you that you're unstoppable to live in the life of your dreams. So it's your boy C-Rock signing off here on the What Are You Made Up show. Until next time, be that one. Let's get to work, yeah. I'm like check one, check two, gonna get